From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1948, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, and John Kennedy were all on the rise as ambitious congressmen, and it was the year, says celebrated Time magazine essayist Lance Morrow, that each of these future presidents made a moral compromise that would shadow the rest of his life and decades of the nation's history. Tonight on Point, 1948, the secrets of power and the hearts of three men who would become president. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with the latest news on the troubles of House Speaker Tom DeLay. This afternoon, at a heavily attended question and answer session with reporters, DeLay brushed aside questions about his ethical conduct and political future. "I'm not here," he said, "to discuss the Democrats' agenda." Jibby Martinez is congressional reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She joins me now from Washington. Jibby Martinez, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What was the tone of Tom DeLay in his press conference today?
I would say a little combative and certainly defensive. I mean, you know, he has always been one who has been credited by his colleagues and even his political enemies with not running away from a fight. So I thought what was interesting about today's news conference is that he said he is not going to be talking about these ethics issues anymore at his legislative news conferences. And so I think that that says something about the seriousness that this case has taken on.
What does it say about the seriousness of the allegations themselves? Is Tom DeLay in position to sort of tamp this down by simply not talking about it anymore, or has it become so serious that he can't talk about it without fear of incriminating himself?
It may be a combination of the two, but I'll tell you, one of the things that he is saying and has been saying repeatedly for the last few weeks is that he wants to clear the air before the Ethics Committee. He wants to go and lay out, he says, everything that he has, and so that he can prove to them that he did not do anything wrong. He insists that he did not do anything wrong, and that what he is accused of doing in taking some overseas travel that might have been paid for by lobbyists is a practice that other members of Congress do. The problem for DeLay, and really for the Republicans, is that the Ethics Committee is not functioning right now. So when he offers to go before the committee, it's not a real strongly held valid offer for him to be making, because the committee is not functioning. They have a partisan gridlock. They can't break the impasse, and who knows when they'll be able to start working again.
And yet these allegations keep coming up, and more than allegations. The $500,000 paid to Tom DeLay's wife and daughter, the reports of foreign-financed foreign trips. Who's digging this up if not the Ethics Committee, Jibby?
I'm sorry, who's dealing it?
Who's digging it up?
Oh, who's digging it? Well, it's not the Ethics Committee, you're right. It's been happening through some news reports that have been coming out in the national media. You know, some of these things have actually come out before. For example, the fact that he has his wife and daughter on the payroll has been repeated and reported many times before. So what's happening here, I think, is there's this new environment on the Hill that is driven towards questioning Tom DeLay, partly because he has always operated right on the edge. The members in his conference know that he's gutsy. He goes right to the line of ethical behavior, and that's what makes them win, because he's willing to take those risks. The question is whether he stepped over the ethical line, and that's what people are questioning.
Tom DeLay didn't want to talk about his political future today. What did he talk about?
Well, there was an interesting development. I don't know if you'll remember that right after Terry Schiavo died, he was very critical of the judges.
Of course, he said they'll be called to answer for their actions.
Right. Today, he was asked whether his rhetoric might not have been a little bit overheated, because when you talk to Republicans on the Hill, they say that, you know, the ethics questions aside, one of the things that has really caused them some discomfort are DeLay's comments about the judges. And he today conceded that, yes, he had been too passionate, and that he probably, you know, made a mistake in how he talked about them. Now, that doesn't mean that he's not still critical of the judges. He is still calling for a congressional review of the judicial behavior in that case. He wants that whole case reviewed, and he wants judges to be reviewed. He says that Congress has a responsibility to provide oversight. But he did say that he got carried away by his emotions. He said, I said something in an inartful way, and I shouldn't have said it that way, and I apologize. That was a major statement from Mr. DeLay today.
Jibby, we know Democrats have been very critical. What about on the Republican side now? We saw Congressman Christopher Shea talking about DeLay resigning as majority leader, Rick Santorum saying he needs to explain his actions. How big a crack in the wall of support from Republicans? Is there talk about this being the beginning of the end for Tom DeLay or more lives for him here?
I think that this is really just the very beginning of this for a lot of Republicans. First of all, it has to be emphasized that a majority of the Republican conference, which votes to make him leader, is conservative, and they stand very strongly behind him because he has been the leader of the conservative agenda. There are other Republicans who are worried about the cloud that this is casting over the party, but I think what they're saying to us is, as reporters, they're saying that they want to see some specific provable allegation that he did something wrong. And these stories about trips that he took and the propriety of them, I mean, those are things that have to be investigated. It's not clear that he did anything wrong. And members want to judge in favor of him, so they need more proof. So they say that unless there's something, some new major scandal that breaks out, or if he gets indicted in Texas, where a grand jury is looking into a political action committee that he organized, unless either one of those things happens, they're hanging by and they're standing by him.
Well, for today, and Tom DeLay pugnacious today, as usual. Jibby Martinez, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jibby Martinez, congressional reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with me from Washington. The year was 1948. Givam Hell Harry Truman was president. India's Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated in New Delhi. Former State Department official Alger Hiss was indicted on perjury charges after denying he passed documents to communist spies. And three rising stars on the U.S. political scene, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon, were grasping for the fast track that would ultimately take each of them to the Oval Office, one after the other. In a provocative new book, veteran journalist Lance Morrow explores the lives of the three future presidents in what he describes as the pivotal year of 1948, when all were ambitious congressmen facing major turning points, and the nation was reimagining itself as a global superpower. 1948, says Morrow, was the seedbed of the three men's political futures and a predictor of their falls from grace years later. Tonight on Point, Lance Morrow, three men who would be president, and the dark compromises they made in 1948. You can join the conversation tonight. Does every American president make a deal with the devil to win the White House? Did these three? And with all their flaws, were these the right men for their times? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Lance Morrow. Next month marks his 40th year as award-winning essayist for Time magazine. He's written more than 150 cover stories for Time and shaped American public opinion for decades. Lance Morrow's new book is The Best Year of Their Lives, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon in 1948, Learning the Secrets of Power. Lance Morrow, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you on tonight.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Morrow.
Hello.
So here we are, Lance Morrow, 1948, pivotal events in three men's lives. You are an amazing web weaver. You've woven webs in essays and cover stories for years. So how are you putting this forward? Is this a Lance Morrow conceit, or is this just black and white, hard and fast? This was a pivotal year for these three men.
Well, I've been interested in 48 for a while, and it struck me that it was in 1948 that something major happened to all three of them. The Hiss case began, which, of course, rocketed Nixon to national prominence. Without the Hiss case, his career arguably would have been quite different. Johnson was locked in this life-or-death Senate race down in Texas against Coke Stevenson. Mm. He won it by 87 crooked votes. If he had lost, he had no other way up. He had no, there were no offices, higher offices available. He probably would have gone out and become a rancher.
Kind of a do-or-die moment politically.
Yeah, I think so. And Kennedy had had, in the fall of 47, he'd had his first onset of Addison's disease, which, of course, is a very serious business. It's an insufficiency of the adrenal glands. So he was recovering from that. And then in May of 48, his sister Kathleen died in a plane crash in France. He was quite close to her. He went into a period of depression after her death and so on. But the whole period for him was transformative, I think. And he also, he obviously had to lie about the Addison and did lie for the rest of his career. And about the Addisons, it's very doubtful that he, if the full truth had been known about his medical condition, that he would have been elected to higher office or to the presidency.
So with each of these, you say it pushed them into a kind of realm of moral compromise, a kind of darkness and secrecy.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, in talking about making a deal with the devil, I shy a little bit from that because
you've got all their sins outlined.
Well,
here.
I certainly
in the vernacular.
Yes, well, in the Hiss case, for example, it wasn't. Nixon was pursuing Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss proved to be pretty much guilty as charged, I believe, as charged by Whitaker Chambers. Mm. At the time, it was very difficult for a lot of people to believe this, but Nixon was basically just simply being the prosecutor and the Javert on that case, and he knew a little more about the case than the other members of the about the background than other members of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Lensmore, we've got to take a short break. I must point out, you've got their sins all lined out here. Richard Nixon's sin, anger. Kennedy's lust. LBJ's greed. And off we go from 1948. Jack Beatty, stand by. We'll be right back. Got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Time magazine essayist and author Lance Morrow about a pivotal year in the lives of JFK, LBJ, and Richard Milhouse Nixon. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Time magazine essayist and author Lance Morrow about a pivotal year in the lives of three American presidents in the making. His new book is The Best Year of Their Lives, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon in 1948, Learning the Secrets of Power. He's a longtime Time magazine essayist. He's a university professor now as well at Boston University. You can join the conversation tonight. Does every American president, one way or another, make a deal with the devil? Lance Morrow doesn't like the phrase. We'll come back to it. To do whatever it takes to take the White House. And did you see these three presidents as particularly flawed humans? Do you now? And is the moral die for each of us cast so early and firmly? Was it for these three? Are politicians, by necessity, a breed apart? Are they necessarily without shame? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, we're going to get Lance Morrow to lay his case out in a lot more detail here, but I want to just get your first impressions of the structure that he's laid out here and the secrets he's pointing at around each of these three men.
Well, as I was reading him, I was put in mind of something that Charles de Gaulle said when he came to the United States for John F. Kennedy's funeral in 1963. He said, "This man Kennedy was the country's mask, but this man Johnson, he's the country's real face." And yet, as I was reading, Mr. Morrow, your book, it occurred to me that, no, I think Tom Wicker is writer there. Richard Nixon is much more like... He's one of us. The kinds of things you say about him, his application, hard work, He's not the guy that gets the girl. In fact, he's the guy who says, I'll drive the girl on a date with somebody else. You know, his great virtue is that he outlasts people by being, and he prepares for everything. He prepares for the Inquisition of Hiss. He gets everything right. He works it right down. A lot more Americans are, he was a sort of image of middle class striving and respectability, whereas Kennedy was just this aristocrat, and Johnson, well, he had extra glands. He seemed to come from some other place. But I do see Nixon as much more American.
In that way.
What do you say, Lance Morrow? Richard Nixon as ultimate American, even though he's the disgraced one?
Well, I think that there's a lot in that. I think that Nixon, I find myself. Well, it needs to be said, first of all, that when you're writing about these three guys, you're writing about at least six guys and maybe 18 guys. Each of them has, they have
facet
many
facet.
Sides. But each of them, to be simplest about it, has a pretty good side or a very good side or even a near great side, and each of them has a side that is really pretty bad. I mean, Johnson was a tremendous figure, but there were so many great things about him, near great things, generous, wonderful things, and then there was a monstrous side to him. But Nixon, I think it is true that he was there was something very Wicker was on to something when he called his book One of Us. There was something very distinctly, as Jack Beatty said, there's something very distinctly American about him. And even the quality of his resentment, which is kind of the fuel that kept him moving for a long time.
His sin of anger or envy, as you put it.
Well, he really bridled at the unfairness of things and the unfairness of Kennedy's advantages, Kennedy's everything, his looks, his money, his getting away with stuff that Nixon Nixon never got away with anything, but Kennedy.
Those guys did.
So I think that there's a lot to that he was. I find Nixon a very poignant character, even though there was a lot to dislike about him. I grew up in a household in which my mother, a journalist in Washington, loathed, despised, detested Nixon.
And you say every time she got near him would put a jab in somehow,
it
to him.
He couldn't hold his liquor at all, and they would occasionally meet in the late 40s and at a political dinner, and they would have a few drinks together, and my mother would start saying, you know, Dick, you ought to get out of politics. You don't know a damn thing about that. So on, you know.
Oh, he must have loved her.
So, well, he would call my father the next day, you know, and say, Hugh, can't you control your wife?
What a picture. Lance's mom. Lance Morrow, I don't want to skip past the picture that you paint of the country in 48 and the kind of core of each of these experiences that you tie to central compromises, central flaws in no small part in each of these future presidents. Take us back to the country at that moment and you're saying it wasn't just a pivotal moment for three men, but actually the country was growing into a new skin.
I think it was very much a pivotal moment for the United States. A lot of things were ending and a lot of things were beginning. It was in 48, television as a mass medium was just taking off. The conventions that year were the first to be televised. Very importantly, the baby boom was just getting going. Bill Clinton was 2 years old. W. Bush was 2 years old. The first Levittown opened. The whole suburban American consumer, the great explosion of the conversion of America from a wartime economy to a mass consumer economy.
And the country's sense of itself, American sense of themselves?
That's one of the things that I found most interesting about zeroing in on this year, because here the country had come out of this triumph in World War II, and yet there was this funny anxiety and melancholy mixed in with a promise and hope for the future and so on. We had segued directly out of a world war, which ended the way it ended in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, almost straight into Cold War, into nuclear anxiety, with a tremendous preoccupation with secrets. One of the motifs of this book is secrets and atomic secrets, espionage, all of that. Johnson, Nixon, Kennedy all had secrets that they were harboring, of stolen votes, Addison's disease concealed, the House on American Activities Committee, Nixon going in after these kind of secrets. So the Cold War was beginning. It was a moment of transformation for America in which I think America was very much uncertain about where it was going. And so there was a certain interesting anxiety, among other things, going on.
The country kind of cracking open in a way, and these three rushing to get in there.
Yeah, exactly. They saw, each of them saw...
the brass ring was dangling out there.
Well, I'm not sure they saw far enough to see as it, but they were very ambitious, and they saw their openings. And Nixon particularly saw what he could get out of the Hiss case. Johnson, of course, had to win, or he would have been out of it.
Take us into these three stories. You write, and it's interesting, you say, what's striking in the three beginnings in 1948 is the way in which they predict the ends, years later, of each of these. The three tales, you say, have a symmetry, a Newtonian reciprocity or Shakespearean dynamic of comeuppance. A cold, poetic justice manifests itself in each denouement. So take us to 1948 with each of these guys. What is it about their story, their situation then, that you tie to their end? And none of the ends were very good.
Well, I was struck. Well, as you say, we have an assassination in 63 and then two subsequent presidents driven from office. Mm. In Nixon's case, here he hounded, he was pursuing the secrets of Alger Hiss. He was delving into the secret lives of Whitaker Chambers and Alger Hiss. And all of that business. And it is interesting to note that Carl Bernstein, who was one of the hounds pursuing
hounds of hell
Nixon,
the press who pulled
at
him
the
down.
End. I mean, Nixon ended being pursued, his secrets being divulged and so on. Carl Bernstein's father had been a labor organizer in Washington and a communist who... who was
must have hated Nixon.
Dodging subpoenas from the House on American Activities Committee. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Nixon's pursuit of Hiss foreshadowed his own downfall in Watergate when he was pursued by the investigators of Watergate. Lyndon Johnson's ran an extraordinary campaign against Coke Stevenson, which he managed, among other things, some amazing half-truths and untruths and so on about Stevenson, including the idea that the rather conservative, really quite conservative Stevenson was somehow a bit of a commie, you know, and was in
he
bed
was old
with,
school, but no communist.
Well, indeed. And anyway, that, it seemed to me, foreshadowed Lyndon Johnson's own decline and fall in the lies and the all of the entanglements of Vietnam, which finally drove him from office. And Kennedy's the death of his sister and so on was part of this enormous motif of death that has haunted the Kennedys and has become sort of melodramatized as the Kennedy curse.
And remind us of that death. That was Catherine, his sister.
Kathleen. Yeah, and it was Kathleen. She wanted very much to marry a man who was already married. His name was Peter Fitzwilliam. He was a very rich, rakish English peer. Her mother, Rose, threatened to disinherit her and disown her and treat her as dead if she married this married man, who would presumably have gotten divorced. Anyway, she and Fitzwilliam were flying down for a weekend of rest on the Riviera, and there was a terrific thunderstorm in the Rhone Valley, and the plane went down, and the two crew members and Fitzwilliam and Kathleen Kennedy were killed. immediately the Kennedys began lying about that one, too.
What happened? Why they were there?
Yeah, they said...
They denied a relationship.
Said Kathleen was just hitching a ride on this plane with a casual acquaintance, Fitzwilliam. Well, in fact, she wanted desperately to marry the guy, and she was very much in love with him, and so on and so on.
And but this was the sibling that JFK was closest to?
Yeah, they were very close, and she was quite a person. She had gone over to England, and she had made an interesting life for herself over there, mainly, I think, to get away from the fairly totalitarian control of Joe Kennedy.
One can only imagine and probably sympathize. And how do you pull this into Kennedy's diagnosis with Addison's? I guess he got the last rites when he was coming back from England. And the secrets that lead to his downfall.
Well,
at least metaphorically, as you'd have it.
Kennedy, the crisis of the Addison's disease was the most serious that he had faced, and then the death of his sister put him into a period of real melancholy and depression. He was not normally; he was a very buoyant character, very easy. You know, he didn't. This was not typical of him, but he fell into a period when he would ask friends, "What do you think the best way to die is?" And his answer was to die in battle. But he did become preoccupied and depressed and morbid and so on. But I think he moved out of this period eventually, much more with a sense of being his own man and wanting to be a politician in his own right, not merely because his father had pointed a finger at him after Joe Jr.'s death and said, "You're the next in line, you're going to run for Congress, and you're going to be the standard bearer for the family." He became more independent, I think.
But where's the Newtonian reciprocity here?
In the secrecy
around his disease, you're saying he'd have to be secret the rest of his life about it, essentially.
If there was a deal with the devil, it had to do with the concealment of a rather significant information about himself, about his health, and so on. And that persisted, that went on from the very end to the very end. Kennedy was a guy who, as we know, and as has come out later, had an extraordinarily complicated and risky personal life, not only with sex, but with the Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Max Jacobson, who injected him.
The drugs that kept him going.
Yeah. And so there was the pact, if there was one, was one of really unusual degree of concealment about what was really going on. And there was this radiant facade of the Kennedy family and so on. And I mean, it was very much in keeping with his father's way of doing this. His father had constructed this highly photogenic, wonderful Catholic American, terrific family, and one of them was retarded. They concealed Rosemary's retardation. He got a lobotomy, a disastrous lobotomy for Rosemary, and in fact concealed it from his wife Rose. So they concealed Rosemary. They concealed Joe himself had a very risky. I mean, he had a mistress, Gloria Swanson, and many, many other girlfriends, and he had a public facade, and then he had as is well known, a very complicated private life.
Sex life, shall we say. Jack, Lance Morrow is tough on all three. He says all three of these, JFK, LBJ, Nixon, suffered what can only be called personality disorders. He says Nixon and Johnson would be accused of clinical paranoia. But he's maybe toughest, I wonder what you think, on JFK. He says Kennedy's personal recklessness raised an imponderable question about his common sense and, as it were, his moral sanity.
Yeah, I think that's a very good phrase about John F. Kennedy. And, you know, you wonder why. There's a poignant comment of his, I forget, in one of the biographies, where someone asked him about his mother, and he said, "My mother, what did she do? She prayed and she shopped." And his father was the mother in that family. That is, his father was the person who gave and who nurtured and who. But that made him extremely vulnerable to his father. I mean, there was no counter. Rose was not present. And in a way, I think the old man really did. I won't say corrupt, but that shadow was one that he couldn't. He really just couldn't get out of. And it's interesting, his favorite movie of the year was Red River, in which the Montgomery Cliff character, rebels against the John Wayne trail boss and tries to become independent. And at the end he does, but only after a terrible fight. But in a way, I don't think that really happened to John Kennedy, that he was in some ways blighted by mom not being there and dad being so important. And setting such a terrible example in personal relations.
Lance Moore, we just got a minute before the break. What about JFK? He seems to take your heaviest blows.
I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, but I guess that's probably. I'm not sure I would agree with that, but I think I do say many nice things about him too. I agree completely with what Jack Beatty just said about the word blighted is not too strong. I think the old man, he was a very interesting, powerful, and very peculiar guy, and I think he had an immense effect. And I think the absence, the complicated absence of his mother's physical affection had a big. This was true in all three guys, by the way, which is very interesting. Their relationships with their mothers. I hasten to say that all this kind of armchair psychologizing can get you in trouble, but you'd be nuts to ignore, I think, the facts such as these.
Lance Morrow, not afraid of trouble in this one. Lots of projection here. We're talking with Time magazine essayist Lance Morrow. His new book is The Best Year of Their Lives, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon in 1948. You can join us. Did you see these three presidents as particularly flawed humans? And do you now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Time magazine essayist and author Lance Morrow about a pivotal year in the lives of JFK, LBJ, and Richard Milhouse Nixon, three American presidents in the making. His new book is The Best Year of Their Lives. You can join our conversation tonight. Are politicians by necessity a breed apart? Are they necessarily without shame? Does it matter to you as long as they produce results? And with all their flaws, were these the right men for their times or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eric is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of yours, Mr. Morrow, and I was actually a college good friend of your brother, Rob's. I hope he's well.
Oh.
This is my question is really this, and I'll take the answer off the air. Yeah. My question is, since 1948, and particularly since the end of the Nixon presidency, do you find that there was a trend, and most recently was sort of epitomized it, where we've seen the president run as an amalgam of these three personalities rather than sustaining an individuality and a political belief and philosophy that defines them? I find that each year and each presidency since then, we've had presidents that are more and more compromising to the point where I wonder where this is going. Is this president going to be simply in the future a figurehead that's bland philosophically and politically? And I'd be very interested in your answer.
Oh, Eric, it's hot. Thanks very much. Lance Morrow, an amalgam of LBJ, JFK, and Richard Nixon and every president now, or as Eric says, more and more compromised?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't offhand think of George W. Bush that way. I'm not sure I would think of Ronald Reagan in that way. I'm interested.
I hear you leaving one Bill Clinton out of that list.
I was just coming to Clinton, and I'm interested in Clinton as a Clinton. There's a famous picture of Clinton in the Rose Garden shaking hands when he was 17 years old with JFK and Boys Nation thing. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in Clinton as a combination of Nixon and Kennedy. He had certain qualities of Nixon's, I think.
Describe those.
Well, What do I mean by that? He had some of Nixon's cunning. I think his triangulation, the Dick Morris side of Bill Clinton, it seemed to me, had a certain. You know, I think they actually had a relationship in which he talked to Nixon a bit. You know, he would get back channel advice from Nixon and so on. But
anger, like the grocer's son from California in Little Rock Boy.
I don't detect that in Clinton. I don't see that. I could be wrong. I don't really know.
But are you saying that Nixon, Clinton, was really that much more politically, I don't know, fiendishly willing to do what it took than LBJ, than JFK?
That Clinton was?
Nixon, for that matter.
Well, Clinton, I think, is a kind of political genius. I think he's very, very, he's arguably one of the best politicians ever to occupy the White House. I'm not sure that, I mean, I can see traces. It seems to me that one of the things that interested me about these three men, and one of the reasons I wanted to write about them, is that when the baby boom was in its formative, adolescence, late adolescence, and in its draftable years and so on, these three were the Easter Island heads on there. These three were the big,
sure, the big
icons. They were the presiding gods of that era. And there was terrible treachery and horror involved in, number one, the assassination, which is in 1963,
Kennedy's.
A terrible trauma for everybody. And then these two essentially regarded as betrayers in the sense that they were Lyndon was the guy who, you know, got him into
the war,
drafted the war and all that stuff. And
Nixon with honesty and their downfall.
Yeah. And so that these three marked that generation, I think, very heavily. And one can see influence. I think one of the things that interests me is the Munich model versus the Vietnam model. Now, Munich, the lessons of Munich, which educated Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, their whole World War II generation.
That is, don't tolerate any offense.
You don't compromise with the bad guys. Mm-hmm. You don't compromise with the monsters. Saddam Hussein, Hitler, you go right after them. You do not do what Chamberlain did and said, well, okay, just a little bit of Czechoslovakia and that's it. And, you know, you don't compromise.
And so back in a big way with George W. Bush.
So, right. Well, what I'm saying is there was the Munich model, which was responsible really for Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It was Munich logic that got us into Vietnam.
We will draw the line.
Then in the fullness of time, you have the Vietnam lesson, which is, for God's sake, don't go into third world countries in get involved in this kind of situation. Beware the arrogance of power. Beware thinking that just because you've got all these expensive weapons, you can win a battle on somebody else's territory in the jungles or in the desert or where they're fighting guerrilla war and so on and so on. I think that Iraq is in some sense a collision of Munich and Vietnam. It's a collision of these. Now George W. Bush leaned toward the Munich logic, which is essentially his father's logic. His father was, you know, in World War II and all of that. And Clinton was a creature of the Vietnam lessons. And so it seems to me that one can conceive of this struggle in Iraq as a, among other things, a collision of those two principles.
And what about JFK, LBJ, Nixon? Did they grow into a Vietnam view with I mean, JFK was hardly around long enough, but he had to deal with Cuba.
Well,
and the missile crisis. LBJ and Nixon, did they come around from the Munich starting point?
Well, I think JFK was, I mean, if you read his inaugural address, it is a very militant.
Yeah.
We will go anywhere, pay any price.
Any burden.
You know, bear any burden. That was essentially an extension of the Munich idea that we will go. It's sort of Wilson plus Munich. Lyndon Johnson, I think, was just torn apart by his immense ambivalence about. I think he knew pretty early on that it was not a winnable thing, and Nixon, of course, was handed. It was really quite unfair. I mean, he was handed this terrible mess, and the only argument is, could he have left a lot earlier and many deaths earlier, or did he need to pursue this peace with honor idea? He and Kissinger.
All the way. Max is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Max, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I just want to say thank you very much for taking my call, and I wanted to let Mr. Morrow know that I am a big fan of his, and it's an honor to be speaking with him.
Great. Well, what's on your mind, man?
Thanks very much.
Well, I was just going to ask another question to follow up on the idea of personality that I think the previous caller had mentioned, and I think you had mentioned before the break, which is this. I was wondering, in your analysis of politicians and government over all these years, you had mentioned certain personality traits of these three men, Johnson, Kennedy, and Nixon. And I was curious as to what you think about this. Do you think that there are many other people in Congress who have these personality traits? And also, how do you find the environment of Congress? Do you think that it is an environment that allows these people with such personalities to, play out their dreams of power?
Max, we got it. Lance, more.
You mean? It sounds as if you're referring exclusively to negative traits of one kind or another. I certainly did not mean to suggest that the traits of Kennedy, Nixon, and Johnson were all negative. On the contrary, I think they had, as I say, they had very admirable traits. All three of them.
You give Nixon the virtue of diligence, Kennedy courage, Johnson this deadlocked greed and generosity.
Yeah, but Johnson thought big, and he had the question that Max asks is really has to do with the nature of the kind of people who go into politics and whether there's some kind of peculiarity in the it is a rather odd career to go into, considering the demands that it makes, the dangers that it makes. I mean, who would want to go into politics? What normal person would want to go into politics and be scrutinized in some of the ways that politicians are scrutinized? It takes either very high idealism to endure that kind of thing, or an ambition that might be somewhat unsavory.
But there's the limelight. There's the Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Deeds high ideal model that you're going to go off and do something great. You discount it?
Yeah, no, I don't. I don't discount that at all. I would say, in answer to Max's question, that it is such, 'cause Congress is such an interesting mixed bag of characters that it would be really difficult to generalize. I think one has to be careful of the temptations. We all know about the temptations of power, the temptations of politics, and you do get rather peculiar refractions of personality when people come in, see the possibilities of power, and when they get too ambitious. But this is older than Shakespeare and older than the first literature we've ever seen. So,
Jack, what do you think? Is it ever thus? I mean, you've got Lance Morrow working on these three guys. He could go to work maybe on any three politicians and bring us quite a tale. Do you see three extraordinarily shadowed figures here, or run of the mill?
Well, I was trying to find that that quotation from F. Scott Fitzgerald where he says the rich are different from you and me.
Yes.
But the first line of it is they're hard where we are soft, and then it goes on. And I think that's true of people in politics. And Max Weber put it this way, that in private life we practice what he called an ethic of ultimate ends. That is, we tell the truth, we're faithful, we pay our taxes, we follow the law. Politicians have to practice what he calls an ethic of responsibility. That is, they can't save their souls. That's not what it's about. It's about saving us. And they have to be judged by their results, not their motives or the shadows in their motives, but just by the results.
Jack, thanks for being with us. Lance Morrow, when you look back next time, are these going to be, are every three presidents equally shadowed?
No, I think these were unusual cases. Very interesting guys, but unusual guys.
Well, it's quite a saga and a great new book. We appreciate you being with us tonight, Lance.
Thank you.
The book is The Best Year of Their Lives, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon in 1948, Learning the Secrets of Power. Lance Morrow, thanks for being with us. Listeners, in a moment, a long-lost poem written by Tennessee Williams is discovered in New Orleans. This is On Point. A previously unknown poem by playwright Tennessee Williams has been discovered in a blue exam booklet that Williams used for his Greek final in 1937 when he was a student at Washington University in St. Louis. The poem reveals the despair and failure that Williams felt at age 25, 8 years before he would find success with the Glass Menagerie. Washington University professor Henry Chavez uncovered the work at a bookstore in the French Quarter of New Orleans. In this radio diary, Henry Chavez reads a portion of the poem and explains how he happened upon Tennessee Williams' long-lost work.
Well, it was sheer accident. I was in New Orleans to deliver a paper about a play that I had just produced, which is called Mi Vasha. It's a play by Tennessee Williams that he wrote during his year at Washington University in St. Louis. It was a play that was received very badly at the time and was one of the main reasons he left Washington University in some disgrace. We produced this play, which had been in our Olin Library since 1937. I went to New Orleans to speak about the production and found myself in the Faulkner House bookshop. I was looking through some first editions of Williams, some signed copies of plays, and I asked the proprietor if there were any other materials of Williams, any other paper ephemera. And he brought me out a fairly large folder and seemed very gracious and helpful. And then I found this plastic sheath. And inside was a blue book. Like any student would take a final exam today, that's exactly how it looks. I realized immediately it had his name on it, of course, T.H. period Williams, and he had doodled T.O.M. at the top in pencil, and a kind of electric shock is what I felt when I realized that I was holding this examination book that I had just been speaking about at this conference. I had talked about the fact that there were two reasons why Williams left Washington University: his unsuccessful play and a Greek examination, never dreaming, of course, that I would come across it. So I had a feeling of absolute electricity. But then when I actually realized that there was a poem here, which presumably had never been seen before because it was there in this blue book, and I read the poem, I felt something different. It was more of a sense of sympathy, of compassion for a young man, the way I would feel it for any student who was failing. He knew he was failing. It's a poem written in a state of absolute despair. It's a very beautiful poem as well, if I may say so. The title was there, written as Sad Song. Then it was rubbed out, erased out, and on top of it was written in pencil again, Blue Song. Obviously blue, suggesting both the pun on the blue book, but also on the blue mood that he was in at the time. Let me just read you the opening. Blue Song. I am tired. I am tired of speech and of action. If you should meet me upon a street, do not question me, for I can tell you only my name and the name of the town I was born in. But that is enough. And then it goes on. The imagery is very poignant, very powerful. It talks about not having a name, talks about not mattering whether tomorrow arrives anymore. He says, in the heart of me, you will find a tiny handful of dust. And I think that expresses very succinctly what his mood was when he wrote this poem. He flunked the Greek course. He received D's in two other courses. He got a B in the English course that he had the one-act play for. And, of course, he had to acknowledge the fact that he wasn't going to make it. He was removed from school and then eventually ended up at the University of Iowa, completed his degree, and found that much more to his liking. But that was just a passing through, and then ended up going to New Orleans. And then in New Orleans he was able to acknowledge his sexuality, things that he was able to do that he could never do in the Midwest. And he found the name that he seems to be craving in this poem. Of course, the name was Tennessee.
I got them St. Louis blues, yes, there's new air I can be.
Tennessee Williams scholar Henry Chavez is chair of the Performing Arts Department at Washington University in St. Louis. The poem he discovered, titled Blue Song, and the Blue Book, where it was written, are now housed at Washington University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.